welcome to Tokyo Game Life, a Tokyo-based video game podcast focusing on Nintendo and gaming culture in Japan's capital. It's your slice of gaming life in Tokyo. I'm your host, Mono, and I'm in the midst of a classic Japanese summer. A lot of heat, a lot of sweating, but also a lot of kakigori, so I can't complain. On this episode, I'm joined by returning guest and fellow Tokyo resident Genki to chat about the Square Enix Cafe and Artnia. Part merch shop, part restaurant, both these locales have a lot of interesting things to experience and discover. If you love Square Enix games, you won't want to miss it. Plus, Genki is also joining me to talk about not one, but two Nintendo Directs. And in the game section, I'll be talking about two puzzly pixel platformers, Kirby Tilt and Tumble and Elekhead. Let's jump right into this episode's feature on the Square Enix Cafe in Artnia with Genki. This episode's feature is all about the Square Enix Cafe in Artnia, two cafes slash merch shops located in Tokyo. Joining me is my first ever returning guest. So guest, please introduce yourself.
Hi everyone, I'm Genki. I'm a game enthusiast living in Tokyo, and I like taking pictures around Tokyo and going to different events.
Thanks again for joining me. How are you enjoying the Tokyo weather these days?
Oh boy, it's hot. Yeah, you need air conditioning at this time. Otherwise, you'll just melt.
Well, if you want to escape the Tokyo heat, you can sit in the air-conditioned Square Enix Cafe located in Akihabara. So, Genki, for those who don't know, what is the Square Enix Cafe?
Oh, the Square Enix Cafe is a cafe in Tokyo, and it's themed on the Square Enix properties. And they'll rotate like the theme like every couple of months, and they'll sell like foods and merchandise related to those games.
How many times have you been there, and do you remember the first time you visited?
There's two in Tokyo. I've been to the Akihabara. One is in Akihabara, and one is in Shinjuku, outside of the Square Enix headquarters building. And I've been to the Akihabara one twice, and the other one twice as well.
The main gimmick of the cafe is theming it around a specific game. Right now they have the Final Fantasy VII 25th Anniversary Collaboration event going on. What themes have you seen on past visits?
The first time I went was to the Artnia Cafe outside the Square Enix headquarters, and then they had a Dragon Quest theme. Mm. So I had like this slime pancakes, shaped pancakes. And the Akihabara one, I went to the Kingdom Hearts anniversary event cafe.
Like I mentioned earlier, there's a Final Fantasy VII 25th anniversary theme going on right now. What are your thoughts on this collaboration?
Oh yeah, I really enjoyed it. It was really cool. And I went to both of them, the Akihabara one and the one in Shinjuku, the Artnia Cafe. And I really like them both. The one in Akihabara is a lot more of an attraction. It's way more decorated. They have way more pictures and things on display. I thought it was really awesome.
I visited the Akihabara Cafe for the first time ever yesterday. The first thing I noticed is that it was much bigger than I expected. It could easily fit a few dozen people. And most of the patrons, I would say, are women. Did you also have that same experience?
Oh, when I went to the Akihabara one, it was mixed. I didn't notice any difference. But when I went to the Artnia one, I was the only guy there. So the Artnia one, it was definitely all women. And the Akihabara one was, when I went there, it was mixed.
Yeah, Final Fantasy in general has a large female fan base, and the cafes are pretty stylish. When I visited the Akihabara Cafe, it really feels like you are immersed in the Final Fantasy VII theme. The music is playing, and scenes from the game are playing on the TVs, and they even have a ton of art. Plus, even really, really obscure games like Before Crisis has its own framed artwork.
Yeah, that's one of my favorite parts of the cafes, is the atmosphere. They're blasting the game's music all throughout while you're dining. And the menu items are also themed around the different characters. So, for example, at the Akihabara Cafe, I got Kent's fifth bun, and it was really good. And also like the theme, the desserts and drinks They're all really good. And they tasted quite good this time. Like when I went to the Kingdom Hearts one, the food quality was really, really bad. It tastes like airplane food.
Oh, really?
Or it tastes like when you go to the maid cafes, it tastes like really bad, those kind of cheap kind of food. Yeah, but this Final Fantasy one is actually, the quality was improved a bit more compared to the Kingdom Hearts menu.
Yeah, I had the black masala curry with the Buster Sword inserted into it, and my wife had the Abura Soba. You really only get two entree choices, and my wife didn't like the Abura Soba at all, but we did both enjoy the pork bun. I thought the curry was all right. They give you a pretty good portion, but you're really going there for the atmosphere and not so much the food.
Yeah, I concur with that. Definitely the Akihabara one is very more touristy. Don't go there for the food. Just go there for the attraction, the atmosphere, the pictures, and the theme. Yeah, that's the coolest part.
There's also a merch shop connected to the cafe. Did you find anything interesting in there?
Yeah, I like the merch shop. They have a lot of cool items. A lot of them are really expensive. Like the t-shirt was like $40 or something like that. Yeah, but they have a lot of cool like clear files and stickers. I picked up a few of the Final Fantasy VII 25th anniversary stickers and a couple clear files.
One thing I noticed in the merch shop was some Octopath Traveler merch, and they had a really nice phone case. But I think a lot of Square Enix goods are pretty expensive. They consider themselves kind of the austere game developer, so their prices are a bit higher than, say, a Pokemon plushie, for example.
Yeah, for sure. They were quite pricey. Mm. So I try not to spend too much. I ended up spending maybe like $30.
Right.
That was just on stickers and clear files. So if I bought anything else, it would have cost hundreds of dollars. Yeah, it's quite pricey, but it's really cool the stuff they have there. They have a lot of different merchandise from all the different games.
And while the Square Enix Cafe is their main shop, there's also Artnia, which you talked about earlier, which is actually right next to Square Enix's headquarters in Shinjuku. So I visited Artnia recently, but I wasn't able to reserve a spot in the cafe because they were all booked up for even about a month. How different is the food in Artnia compared to the Akihabara Cafe?
Yeah, the quality is very, very different. It's like night and day. Mm. It's quite funny. The Artnia Cafe, it's located outside of Square Enix's headquarters. And the workers there, they often go for lunch there when it's empty. But I think now it's quite filled up because everyone's booked for the Final Fantasy VII event. But yeah, the food there is really good. Like they take their job seriously. Like the waiters, they are like really, they're dressed up properly and like they are really attend you well at your seat. And you can see the food is prepared much, much better standard than the Akihabara one. So it's a really good cafe or slash restaurant. And they take their job much more seriously in terms of the quality of the food than compared to the Akihabara cafe. So the food there is actually really good. And the drinks and the cocktails, they all taste really good.
Artnia is also definitely more artistically designed and has much more merch than the Akihabara Cafe. But maybe the most impressive part of the store is the crystal room in the back. What did you think of that place?
Yeah, that's so awesome. There's this cool, like, dark, blacked out area, but right. With lots of crystals. And there's a cool fountain, like, flowing in the middle of the room, like there's water that is just dropping down from the ceiling into this cool materia slash crystal Final Fantasy crystal fountain. Yeah, it's really awesome. And they have all these like really expensive figurines and merchandise and jewelry on display.
Yeah, I was really impressed because it definitely looks like a place from a Final Fantasy game. And actually, I didn't realize those were materia. I was just thinking those were like playpen balls. But I guess it is materia.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they're kind of glowing.
And yeah, they have a lot of like really impressive statues from not just Final Fantasy, but also some of their other past games as well. Like I saw some Secret of Mana statues in there, which was really cool. My one complaint is that there's a lot of mirrors in there. So it's kind of hard to take a picture because everything is like reflecting on everything else.
Yeah, there's so many mirrors in there. Like, I tried to take pictures, but I don't want to show my face. It's kind of impossible because they have all these mirrors inside there, angled in all different directions. So there's lots of mirrors, so it's hard to take pictures.
So, Genki, would you recommend the Square Enix Cafe and Artnia to Square Enix fans in Tokyo?
Definitely, yeah. I think they're a must-see for any Square Enix fans. I'd recommend the Akihabara first because it's more of a tourist attraction, and there's like more things on display, like pictures, and even like the Akihabara one had a Buster Sword in the cafe as well. But the Artnia one is more like artistic and more like a bit more fancy, but it's a bit less of an attraction. But definitely go there if you want to see the Square Enix headquarters and you want to see that cool crystal room.
I too would recommend it. Artnia might be hard to get a reservation, but the merch shop and the magic crystal room is definitely worth checking out. I think the Akihabara's cafe appeal might be heavily based on your interest in the current theme, but if they are featuring a game that you like, it's certainly worth visiting. By the way, I want to hear some of your thoughts on the recent Final Fantasy VII announcements.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I loved it. It was like Christmas came early. Yeah, there's so many cool announcements that I wasn't expecting, and they all dropped it all in one short 10-minute video. So I thought it was really impressive. I was like, oh, that's how you should do anniversary celebrations. It had so many cool announcements from like Crisis Core coming to Switch and all the other consoles, and the Final Fantasy VII Rebirth, which I'm looking forward to a lot. So yeah, I really enjoyed the anniversary announcements.
Yeah, I noticed they had the Crisis Core reunion ads playing on the Square Enix Cafe when I went there yesterday.
Oh, really? Okay, they weren't there when I was there because it was before the stream. But that's cool, they're showing them now.
Do you have any guess for the subtitle for the third Final Fantasy VII game?
I thought it was going to be Reunion, but they used that already. So now I'm thinking maybe Rewrite, like Rewrite, because it has like a double meaning as well. So like the other ones, they have double meaning. So maybe like Nomura said that the titles have meaning. So, and he wants to share them with us later. So I think, it would be interesting to see what the meanings behind the titles are.
Okay, Genki, you're going to stay with me as we get into not one, but two Nintendo Directs. June has been filled with game announcements, and Nintendo finally decided it was their time to throw their hat into the ring. While in the past Nintendo had an E3-branded Direct, the lack of an E3 this year meant Nintendo could do whatever they wanted. And we got a Xenoblade 3 Direct, plus a Nintendo Direct Mini Partner Showcase, focusing on third-party games. Let's talk about the first one. Genki, what game from the Partner Showcase stood out for you?
There were two games, actually, that stood out for me in the Partner Showcase. The first one was Harvestella from Square Enix. That looked really cool. And I like the art style. It looked kind of like the Bravely Default series art style. So that was cool. And also the Persona games finally coming to the Switch. Yeah, those were the two things that really stood out for me.
Right, I agree. Those are two of probably the bigger announcements. Harvestella is a new life simulation RPG from Square Enix. I tried to look exactly who was making it, but I couldn't find that much information. But the developer is listed as Square Enix, so it's not like it's Tokyo RPG Factory. And the gimmick is that you fight monsters and you farm as the seasons change. And there's also quietus, which seems to be a terrible time where you lose all your crops. So you really have to plan around these catastrophic events. These types of life simulation games have gotten pretty popular recently, mostly due to Stardew Valley and Animal Crossing. Interesting to see like a bigger company put a lot of money and put a lot of effort towards a genre that really is more popular in the indie sphere.
Yes, I really like the style of the game. It looked really cool. And yeah, it'll be interesting to see which part of Square Enix is developing it.
And Harvestella comes out November 4th, so Switch has a pretty loaded back end of the year. The last announcement was all about Persona. Persona 3 Portable, Persona 4 Golden, and Persona 5 Royal are coming to the Switch. Royal is October 21st, and the other titles are likely next year. This is a game Switch fans have been really wanting for years. I mean, Persona 5 is a PS3 game, and Switch is the best-selling console, so do the math. I think this is a title that will probably do pretty well in Japan. Are you a big Persona fan, Genki?
Oh yeah, I like the series, but I haven't played that many, just the 5 and a bit of 4.
Yeah, I've only played 3 actually, and Persona 5 is one of those games that I've said, like, oh, I'll play it, and I keep pushing it back, but I think now is as good a time as any to try it. I was hoping for some Switch-exclusive content, but it seems to be just the Persona 5 Royal that the other consoles got earlier.
Yes, it looks like that way. Hopefully they will include DLC items in the re-release, hopefully. Mm. I think it'll be a good way to play it again, because there's also going to be the next-gen versions, like on Xbox Series and on PlayStation 5.
Yeah, I thought the announcement was like so weird, because it was first at Xbox, and then a little later on they said, oh, it's coming to PlayStation. And then a few weeks later they said, oh, it's coming to Switch. So this is like a very classic, like Atlas-esque weird announcement cycle.
Yeah, I found that really funny how they announced it. They rolled it out really slowly and they waited weeks to announce the Switch versions, which everyone was angry about at the beginning.
Right.
But it's cool that it's coming to all the platforms.
As for the other games, we might as well go in order. The first game shown was Monster Hunter Rise Sunbreak, the new DLC for Monster Hunter Rise. Capcom showed off a roadmap, which includes a lot of new monsters. Are you a big Monster Hunter guy?
No, sorry, I haven't played any Monster Hunter game.
I think maybe that's illegal to be in Japan and not play a Monster Hunter game. So that's true. Just be aware of that. I played World and I liked it, but I didn't feel the need to play another Monster Hunter game. But I did like Monster Hunter Stories 2 on the Switch, which is more like a Dragon Quest Monsters-esque RPG. So I'm kind of like a casual Monster Hunter fan. I didn't pick up Rise, but I'm glad that they're getting content. And the next game revealed was Nier Automata, the End of Yorha edition. This is the 2017 game from Platinum Games, and it really brought the series into the spotlight. It includes all the old features and DLC, plus Switch has some exclusive costumes. This is one of those games that I've been repeatedly pushing off, but maybe I'll try it now that it's on the Switch. And it comes out on October 6th.
Yes, I'm really looking forward to this game. I played it on the PS4 a bit. Having a Switch version would be really cool as well. So I'm just happy that the game can be in the spotlight again, because it's a really good game.
After that, we got Lorelei and the Laser Eyes from Seemingo, the Swedish developers behind Sayonara Wild Hearts. It's a puzzle adventure game with a mostly black and white aesthetic. It really looks like a mix of Layton and Killer 7. The surreal visual style really hooked me, and it has a silly name, so I'm interested in it. And this is one of the first of several 2023 games shown off.
Knowing that it's made by the same studio that made Sayonara Wild Hearts is really impressive. I think that would be really cool.
Next up, we got some returning characters. Super Bomberman R2 is coming out in 2023. This is the sequel to Super Bomberman R, which was a Switch launch game. I owned the first game, and it's just kind of a standard Bomberman game. It's not bad, but it doesn't push the envelope when it comes to Bomberman. It did sell quite well, though, since it was the only Bomberman game available on modern consoles. The new one has a castle mode, where you can build a little base during gameplay, and you can also create and share your own maps. Super Bomberman R Online is shutting down, but that game's mode is being moved into this game, and R2 is coming out in 2023. Are you a big Bomberman fan, Genki?
Oh yeah, I like Bomberman from back in the day on the SNES, but recently I haven't played any of the newer ones. I keep seeing the Bomberman R on the eShop for like $5, so maybe I'll pick it up.
Yeah, the first game is really based on how badly do you want to play any Bomberman. So I got it also for cheap, and I imagine a lot of people got it for cheap as well, but it sold well enough to have another one. So let's see if Konami has kind of a more ambitious idea for this sequel. Mega Man is also back with Mega Man Battle Network Legacy Collection, featuring 10 games, although really it's only 6 games and some alternate versions, kind of like Pokemon Red and Blue. I suppose Capcom was eventually going to release this, but I still think it's pretty surprising to see it come back after all this time. Also, these are not 3-hour games like the classic Mega Man titles. These are full-blown 20-plus hour JRPGs. I've only played 2, but it was very solid, and most hardcore fans say 3 is the best, so maybe I might just jump right into that one. It's another 2023 game. Do you have any history with Mega Man Battle Network?
Not with the Battle Network games, but they do look really awesome, so I definitely want to try this, and I definitely want to pick this one up, because I haven't played any of these games before.
Yeah, it's kind of crazy because all these games are like full-length games. So if you play all of them, it's like over 150 hours of gameplay if you finish 1 through 6.
Wow.
It's a great deal for somebody who doesn't have a lot of money, but they want a lot of game.
Yeah, definitely that one's on my radar.
Rounding out the classic character section is Pac-Man World Repack, a remake and or remaster, who knows, of Pac-Man World for the PS1. I've played Pac-Man World 2 on PS2, and it was kind of an acceptable platformer. I'm not super interested in this game, but I'm glad these older platformers are getting a second chance. I mean, the Klonoa Collection is coming out pretty soon, and these are games that many assumed would never come back. So you can chill with Pac-Man in August. The next game was Blanc from French developer Casus Ludi. It's another black and white game, but this is a co-op focused puzzle title with no dialogue or text. One person is a deer, one person is a fox, and you work together to traverse the terrain. This looks like a game that would be really great to play with your significant other, and visually, it was definitely one of the more striking titles shown off. It's another 2023 game.
Yeah, I really like the art style, the black and white, and I think it's good how Switch are supporting these smaller indie-type games. So yeah, it looks very interesting.
We also got a look at Return to Monkey Island, the first title in that series since 2009. Like the older titles, it's a narrative adventure game, but this time it sports a kind of Picasso-esque art style. I'm not quite sure how to explain it, but it's a very stylized 2D look, and it will actually be out this year. And a Nintendo franchise popped up, Mario plus Rabbids Sparks of Hope, the sequel to the 2017 title. The big focus on this game is that it's much more open compared to the previous game. Exploring the world is less linear, and even in battle, you have way more movement options. In Sparks of Hope, you can freely move around during your turn until you actually attack with your gun. Compared to the past game, where you just selected where you needed to move each time, the flow of the game definitely looks a lot speedier and smoother. I liked the first game, but I did feel that these battles dragged out. I'm not sure if I will pick up Sparks of Hope, but the addition of adding free movement in the battle really does make me a lot more interested than before. And also Bowser joins your team, so it's always fun when you can control him. I thought for sure this would be delayed, but no, it's coming out in October.
I haven't played the first game, but I just noticed the animations in the game. They're really good, and the art style, and it seems like they put a lot of passion and love into the game. So that's what was appealing to me. But yeah, when I get some time, I'll want to try it out. And this second one looks much more interesting because it doesn't have that grid-based movement. So right. I would like to try out the second one.
Yeah, the first one, I thought it's kind of weird because I do think it's a good game and it is well made. But yeah, it is quite slow. Battles take like quite a while. It's not a strategy RPG, so it's not super focused on leveling up your character. So I felt like they could have done more with it, but this one looks a bit more exciting and faster paced. Some smaller games followed Mario. Little Noah Scion of Paradise from Cygames was shadow dropped. Cygames, by the way, partially owned by Nintendo. It's a 2D action RPG. I thought this was a phone game, but actually it's not at all. We also saw Railgrade from Epic Games, a railroad simulator. And RPG Time, The Legend of Wright from Japanese indie developer Deskworks, which is an RPG adventure title that takes place within a comic book. You can change the panels to solve puzzles and do things like draw and erase. Conceptually, it looks pretty similar to The Plucky Squire, but this game looks like it could be very funny and has some clever puzzles.
I like the one from Cygames. That looks really interesting. Yeah, I like that platforming and the JRPG action style stuff.
Right.
So that looks cool. And then this drawing game looks really interesting as well. I like the Plucky Squire game. Kind of in drawing in the book with the pencil lines. So that one looks quite interesting as well.
And of course, we got some Sonic Frontiers. It was the first time they showed off the Switch version, And I thought it ran pretty decently, better than I expected at least. There was definitely some pop-in, but it doesn't look like a massive gap between the Switch and the other versions. They showed off a new part, Cyberspace, which looks more like linear areas that resemble past Sonic levels. And they say it's still coming this holiday.
I thought it showed much better in this Direct than when they showed it before with IGN. So I think the gameplay in this trailer looks much better. I think maybe on Switch, it doesn't look as good as the other PlayStation and Xbox versions, but I think it showed much better in this trailer because they showed the cyber world levels, and they showed some more interesting gameplay. So I think it looked much better here. So hopefully it can be a good game when it releases.
Yeah, a lot of people really freaked out when the IGN videos dropped. I watched it and I didn't think it was terrible. I thought it was just, you know, fairly okay. But there was definitely a huge negative reaction. So I'm kind of wondering like what Sega will do to make it more exciting before launch.
Yeah, I definitely got a negative impression when I first saw the original gameplay footage, just because it was very slow, and not slow, but the music was like kind of Breath of the Wild-ish.
Right.
And it didn't suit Sonic because it really like more fast-paced and like more like high-tempo music usually. So this was like really slow Breath of the Wild piano music. So it didn't match for me. And also like the enemies, the designs were a bit like they look uninspired. They all look kind of the same, like sleek, like robot. They don't have much character to them. That was my issue. And like some of the animations looked a bit stiff in the original trailer. But here it looked a lot more interesting and there was a lot more variety to the environments. So I thought it looked much better.
Other stuff, Live Alive has a demo out right now. There's also Doraemon Story of Seasons, Friends of the Great Kingdom, which is a sequel to the first Doraemon Story of Seasons game. The first title reviewed pretty well, so if you like that game, you will probably like this one. And Minecraft Legends was also shown off, which is a Minecraft RTS. I think that says everything about the game.
Well, I'm looking forward to the Doraemon game and the Live Alive. I'm going to download that demo tonight and try it out.
Oh, yes.
The save carries over to the real game. So I'm going to try it out today.
Yeah, that's a pretty interesting game to bring back because it never came out in the West. And even in Japan, it didn't really sell that well because, of course, it came out like right near Chrono Trigger and Final Fantasy VI. So it's kind of like the black sheep of Square Enix, like JRPGs from that era. But there are some like important people who worked on that game. So it's kind of interesting to see it have a second chance in 2022.
Yeah, it looks awesome. I love the HD 2D style. So it's cool.
Another big title was Dragon Quest Treasures, which was announced at last year's Dragon Quest event. It almost looks like a new Dragon Quest Monsters game, as you make a party of monsters while you explore and find treasure to build up your base. When they showed off this game for the first time, it was a bit vague in what you actually do, but it looks like a standard JRPG, but with more action-oriented field exploration. Like, you can summon your monsters to traverse the areas, including gliding with the Draki, which looks like very Breath of the Wild-ish. It's coming out this year on December 9th.
Oh, it looks really cool. Yeah, it looks like the Dragon Quest Monster games, the hunting games. It looks really interesting, and I'm interested to see how it will do in Japan.
And a few games were only in the Japanese Direct. There's a new Fishing Spirits game, which is a pretty big franchise for Japanese kids. The Switch game sold pretty well, and there's also an arcade version. The big one for me is Ultra Kaiju Monster Rancher, a new Monster Rancher game where you raise the kaiju from the Ultraman series. This is actually getting an English release in the Asian region, so it might come out to the West as well. So what did you think of the games that were only in the Japanese Direct?
They showed some cool games in the Japanese ones that hopefully they get Western releases later on too. The Fishing Spirits one is funny because I always see that in the arcades in Japan. And like they even sell like a Switch peripheral for the first game. It's like a fishing rod Switch peripheral, which is really funny when I see that in the shops. So that game is like super popular in Japan. And it's got like fishing for sharks and other octopuses and other strange animals. So I thought it was interesting. It's getting a new game. And the Monster Rancher one, I'm like, I don't really know what that is. Like, does it have Monster Rancher characters in it?
It just showed like Ultraman characters. So I guess it has like the mechanics of Monster Rancher, but everyone in the game is like from the Ultraman universe.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah. Just the name confused me. But yeah, it was cool seeing the Ultraman kaijus battling. So that one looks interesting as well.
That's kind of an interesting trend recently, is that it's like a classic Japanese anime and then a game. Like we have Doraemon and then Story of Seasons. And we have Ultraman and Monster Rancher. And we also have like Shin-chan and Boku no Natsuyasumi, which also recently got an announcement that it's being localized. So I kind of wonder if we will see more kind of like collaborations between existing anime and like existing game franchises and see them cross over.
Oh, yeah, that's really interesting. Yeah, because it helps a new level of popularity to the existing game franchises, like the Boku no Natsuyasumi. Like before, it wasn't as popular. Oh, it's a popular game, but it's not as well known. But when you put Shin-chan on it, then it can reach a wider audience. And same with the Doraemon game. So yeah, I think it's a good idea and they should do it more.
Do you have any dream collaboration between an anime series and an existing game franchise?
Oh, exist anyone? maybe something like Attack on Titan. What could Attack on Titan? not a Japanese game, but if Spider-Man Insomniac or something.
I don't know. Yeah, that'd be something.
I don't know. How about you? Do you have any idea?
Evangelion, which I think is still really untapped in terms of games, and maybe like Fire Emblem would be really cool because you can like control the robots, and then you can also have the kind of like relationships between like you and the Evangelion characters. I think the Fire Emblem formula could really be used a lot for franchises that have a lot of characters.
Oh, yeah, that would be a cool idea. Yeah. Maybe like Evangelion and FromSoft, they could make another mecha game. But yeah, that's a good idea with the Fire Emblem.
So, Genki, what are your overall thoughts on the Direct?
I was quite impressed. Actually, I wasn't expecting much because it was called a mini. It was a mini Direct, so... They actually showed so many games, like over 25 minutes. And in the Japanese one, it was like 30 minutes. So they showed so many games. So I was pleasantly surprised. And we finally got Persona, the games on Switch, which I was really happy about. So yeah, they showed loads of, there wasn't any big, massive AAA mega hitting games in there, I don't think. But they showed lots and lots of cool, interesting games that I was happy about.
Yeah, it really blew away my expectations. Pretty much everything they showed was at least pretty interesting. I think a big theme is that, yeah, a lot of these are older titles. A huge chunk of people have already played Nier or Persona, for instance, but there is a very large Switch-only or Switch-first audience, especially in Japan. I can see both Nier and Persona 5 selling quite well in Japan, and I think a lot of people underestimate how big these titles on the Switch are for this market.
Yeah, especially in Japan, which has sold 25 million Switches already. So there's a big market for these games that have never been released on Switch before.
Was there anything you expected or wanted that didn't show up?
Of course, just the Nintendo games. even just the Advance Wars 1 and 2 reboot camp. That's what just the release date, because we know it's finished. They just delayed it, unfortunately.
But, right.
I just want the release date for that. And but in terms of third party, I don't think we could have asked for much more.
I was a little surprised that Tactics Ogre Reborn didn't show up, since that was kind of leaked on the PlayStation Store. So I assumed that would be coming out pretty soon, but they're still pretty quiet on when that game is coming out.
Oh, yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, the Tactics Ogre, a remastered game. Yeah. Square Enix are making so many games recently. So
yeah. They're busy over there.
They need to plan out their schedule.
Do you think Nintendo will have a first-party focused Direct anytime soon?
No, I don't think they will until maybe... They don't really do one apart from the beginning of the year and E3 timing. I don't remember them doing ones towards the end of the year. So I think it will be more like single title focused directs, like the Xenoblade Direct, than like a Splatoon Direct. And hopefully we see Bayonetta actually come out this year.
Yes.
So hopefully they'll do a Bayonetta Direct too. But I don't see them doing other directs, a big direct. I think they'll save it for next year when they'll do the big directs with the Zelda Breath of the Wild 2.
I'm wondering, like, I think they still do have announcements for this year, even smaller stuff. Like, for example, the Mario Kart 8 DLC tracks are still coming out, and Golf is still supposed to come out for Nintendo Switch Sports. And of course, like, Advance Wars, like, where is that? And there's also rumor of Metroid Prime remaster or remake or something.
Oh, yeah.
That is, according to rumors, supposed to come out this year.
Oh, wow.
I think there's enough for Nintendo to have, like, maybe like a first party mini direct. But I don't know when they would do it. Like, it's kind of weird for them to do it in July. They can maybe do it like September, like after Splatoon. I'm sure they have other stuff to say. Maybe they don't want to like do a big blowout on Zelda yet until maybe like maybe next year or like very late this year. But I still think there are some things for maybe fall that we don't know about. So we might have, you know, a quote unquote Twitter direct where they just like announce stuff via Twitter. So I think Nintendo will still at least say something interesting sooner than later.
Yeah, I think they'll put some tweets out. Hopefully we get the Zelda ports. Oh, I need a Wind Waker really bad.
Yes, that's also like a big possibility. So yeah, I'm sure Nintendo will have probably something every week that will get our attention. And that was not the only Nintendo Direct. There's also a Xenoblade 3 Direct that they showed last week, introducing the game and a lot of the game mechanics. So Genki, what are your thoughts on what they showed at the Xenoblade 3 Direct?
Oh, I thought it was really cool. The game looks really good and really vast. And also there's so many characters, and I like how you could change their classes really easily. And like everyone is wearing the same clothes. If you change them all to the same class, it's quite funny. I like that. And I also like how the characters combine as well into like they do a fusion into these weird,
yes,
like Evangelion looking dudes. But yeah, I thought that was really cool too. So the game's looking really, really good. I pre-ordered the limited edition, but for some reason, they're sending it separately. Like they're sending just the game in, when did the game come out? In July. And then the limited edition pack with the limited edition goods to come later in like October. But yeah, I'm looking forward to the game.
Yeah, what they showed off was pretty interesting. The series traditionally is pretty deep mechanically. Like there's a lot of options you can do in battle. And the kind of fusion system was pretty similar to Xenoblade Chronicles X, where you had like the robot. And so like the fighting system when you're in the robot is totally different from when you're just a person. So Xenoblade 3 looks the same as well in that regard. Definitely looks pretty exciting. I'm not sure like when I'll pick it up, because Switch is pretty loaded like for the rest of the year. There's definitely a ton of stuff to play, but I think it will be pretty successful. So it's something that a lot of people have been looking forward to. I think it's really crazy though that there are three Xenoblade games on the Switch. Those fans are probably very, very happy. All right, well, Genki, thanks a lot for joining me. Where can people find you?
No problem. You can find me mainly on Twitter. My Twitter handle is Genki_JPN. That's where you can find me. And I tweet about things I see in Japan related to video games, and also just my own opinions on different things to do with games and Japan. But thanks for having me.
Once again, thanks to Genki for joining me. Be sure to check him out on social media. The links are in the podcast description. I mentioned a few episodes back that I bought an Analog Pocket, aka the ultimate handheld gaming machine. Check out that episode to hear my detailed thoughts, but today I want to talk about a, I would say, classic Game Boy Color title. A little game called Kirby Tilt and Tumble, or Korokoro Kirby in Japanese. Korokoro means to roll around. I like how both names use alliteration. That's localization synergy. I want to try and pick up Game Boy titles that likely won't be added to the Switch, games with unique inputs, or take advantage of the Game Boy's handheld form. And I honestly can't think of a better title that encapsulates this idea than Kirby Tilt and Tumble. If you've never touched the game, it's a Kirby spinoff where you control Kirby by moving the Game Boy to roll him around. I did own this back in the day and really enjoyed it. But like with all games you haven't touched in 20 years, there's always that feeling of, uh-oh, is my nostalgia going to be ruined? Thankfully, it wasn't. And honestly, I probably had a better time playing this game now than I did when I played it 20 years ago. Kirby Tilt and Tumble was released in Japan in 2000. It's developed by HAL, of course, but the co-developer is both surprising and kind of obvious. It's Nintendo R&D2, the team dedicated to developing Nintendo hardware. Masayuki Uemura, the father of the Famicom and Super Famicom, is the lead producer for this game. Since Kirby Tilt and Tumble relies entirely around the unique functionality of the game cart, it makes perfect sense to utilize that team for this. It's just kind of funny to think that the same people who created the hardware that would turn Nintendo into a worldwide brand are also working on a strange Kirby spinoff. In fact, it actually didn't originate as a Kirby title at all. It was supposed to star a monkey, an original character. However, apparently Miyamoto convinced them to use Kirby instead. One of the many Miyamoto anecdotes that show either his incredible foresight or strange way of thinking. Kirby is by far the roundest Nintendo character, so he makes perfect sense for this game. If it did star an original character, I doubt it would have sold as much, and you probably would have fans begging to this day to bring that monkey back. The director is Toshiaki Suzuki, who has had numerous roles in Nintendo throughout the years. He directed Super Mario Bros. Deluxe for Game Boy Color right before this. So Kirby Tilt and Tumble has a lot of unorthodox staff, and you really get the feel of their influence on this game. It often doesn't feel like or look like a Kirby game. There are so many unique elements that are new to Kirby and never reappeared again. Having played Kirby in the Forgotten Land and also Kirby 64 and Dream Course this year, you can see a lot of similar DNA in the HAL-led titles. But here, it's very clear that Nintendo R&D 2 weren't simply trying to fit Kirby conventions into the mold of this game, but instead are creating a completely new experience that just happens to star Kirby. Yeah, there are Waddle Dees and Maxim Tomatoes, but the game also has a number of enemies and obstacles that never appeared again. My favorite are these toy robots that you need to dispatch of via puzzles, but they can also help you. There are so many buttons, switches, bumpers, and other things in your way that you've never encountered in any Kirby game. There are also no power-ups outside the mic, which is very rare. All these distinct elements make it feel remarkably fresh for Kirby veterans. The format of the game is similar to most platformers. You're trying to reach the end of the stage. Instead of going from left to right, Tilt and Tumble has a top-down view, with you tilting Kirby around to find the goal. The majority of the time you are going up, which makes sense in a traditional game, but ironically you are often tilting the Game Boy away from you as you progress in the level. Now's probably a good time to talk about the actual hardware and how Kirby can move around. The cart has an accelerometer embedded in it. The top of the cart is notably larger than most Game Boy titles, and it has an awesome-looking pink translucent shell. Easily one of the coolest Game Boy carts. Did you know that in Japan, the Game Boy Pokemon games do not have colored carts? Gen 1 is gray, and Gen 2 is black. Gen 3 does have the colors, though. Whoever in the West came up with this marketing gimmick deserves a big raise. Anyways, the accelerometer is actually quite simple. You can technically only move Kirby in four directions, but it doesn't feel rigid when playing the game. They hide it quite well. It feels like you're making 360 loops. You can be very precise in moving Kirby. It's surprisingly accurate and not too sensitive. The real challenge when developing this game is making sure Kirby doesn't wildly roll out of control or fling itself off the map. I never felt like any death or accident was because of the tech. It was always my bad. Kirby has pretty good speed to him. He has momentum, but whipping your Game Boy around doesn't make Kirby faster. Any degree that registers an input is the same. The game has quite a lot of precise platforming and puzzle solving, so you don't want Kirby to go Sonic levels of speed, or else you will be constantly fighting with the controls. The accelerometer tech got a lot better on the GBA, but I was very impressed about how well it held up all these years later. It absolutely works. In addition to tilting Kirby to roll around, you can also pop the Game Boy up to make Kirby jump. This is used quite often to access new areas or even change the power-ups on the board. There are moments where you need to press A or B as well, as certain obstacles react to certain button presses. The gameplay is more diverse than you would think, and it doesn't solely rely on the tilting mechanic. The levels are very different from most Kirby games. It's less centered around Kirby fighting enemies and more on puzzle solving and reflex platforming. Unlike most Kirby titles, you will actually fall into a hole and lose a life. No infinite float here. I died probably more in this game than any Kirby title, but they do give you a lot of lives. I had maybe 40 or so by the end of the game and was never at risk of a game over. It's Kirby, it's got to be on the easier side of things, right? Although Kirby's roly-poly powers are the main selling point, the strongest aspect of the game is by far the level design. Each level feels so creative with its own gimmick. I'm a Kirby fan, but even in the best Kirby games, a lot of stages do feel like extensions of each other. Unlike in, say, Mario, where you can tell each level has a very direct theme or gameplay challenge, many Kirby levels are often more amorphous in terms of what they want to teach you. But in Tilt and Tumble, there are so many one-off ideas and completely new challenges. Even until the last boss battle, they are constantly throwing new things at you. It doesn't feel like they front-load this thing at all. The last world alone has so many completely new obstacles, like panels that close based on what button you press. One of the later stages is a half pipe, another has you timing your jumps to land on spinning clouds. There's levels where you fight against rapids, escape from quicksand. There's so many fun ideas in this game that makes you want to keep playing. The fourth level of every world throws you into a castle stage, and these honestly feel like mini Zelda dungeons. You collect keys, solve puzzles, fight a boss at the end. It's a good change of pace from the other levels that are much more brighter and open. One criticism I have is that the bosses are mostly the same. You fight a ball with an eye and then launch yourself into the eye. There is a good boss fight with Krakko, and the final boss is a ton of fun, but most of them don't really utilize the game's input method in fun ways. Ironically, Wispy Woods is in the game, but he serves as more of a warp point than a boss. Glad Kirby could finally cut him some slack. I think the strong level design prevents the game from feeling dated or relying too heavily on the tilt gimmick. I can see some people thinking, yeah, I get it, you roll Kirby around like a marble after the first world, but fortunately the game has so much more to offer. One question I want to pose is that, does this game even need the tilt gimmick at all? At first I thought, of course, but I've seen online that some people who play on emulators patch the accelerometer out so they can just play it with a traditional D-pad control. I do think playing this only on a D-pad takes away from the game a bit. Kirby just moves too strangely if you control him via a D-pad. I don't think my mind could get over that mental barrier. One issue I had with the game as a kid was that you really needed to sit in a perfect spot to play this game. A lot of the game is tilting Kirby forward, away from your face, so it could catch some nasty screen glare. This isn't a problem with modern backlit hardware at all, but you do often feel hunched over since you need to hold the Game Boy flat for a neutral position. Maybe the developers found this idea to be strange, but wouldn't it make more sense to be moving down on the screen most of the time? That way you would tilt the Game Boy towards you more, which is the natural position most people hold a Game Boy. But in top-down games, you traditionally go up, and perhaps they wanted you to always be in an unorthodox position to make it feel like the tilt controls were a really different experience. There are sub-games you can play if you find a red star in the level, but to play them anytime, you need to pretty much 100% the game, which is actually quite difficult since each level has a lot of tiny stars you need to collect that can easily be missed. But hey, that's replay value. I think a normal playthrough would probably be around 5 hours, which is pretty normal for a Kirby game. Having played it for the first time in 20 years, I have a much greater appreciation of it now than I did when I was a kid. I always remember liking it, but I think I forgot how creative this game is when it comes to its levels and utilizing the input in very fun ways. The bigger backlit screen of the analog pocket certainly helps a lot. It's interesting to think just how many Game Boy titles are likely greatly improved thanks to being available to play on modern hardware. If you've got an analog pocket or a backlit GBC or whatever, I highly recommend Kirby Tilt and Tumble. Even for non-Kirby fans, I think there's enough here that goes against a lot of Kirby game conventions, so you might like it even if you didn't gel with the other Kirby titles. Honestly, this may be the absolutely best Kirby spinoff. I like it more than Pinball, which is a good game, more than Dream Course or Star Stacker. Air Ride is a tough one. I'd have to play that again. I think even calling this game a spinoff is maybe disingenuous despite it being so distinct from the other Kirby platformers. I mean, it's still a platformer like the main Kirby games. Though I guess this also gets into the, is Four Swords Adventure a spinoff or main Zelda game territory? Let's not go down that path. One last thing, this may have been the last game with Whisker Kirby. You know the little dashes on his cheeks instead of the blush? Which is weird since Kirby 64 came out before this game and has blush Kirby. I wonder if Kirby will ever have a multiverse type of thing like Sonic with Kirby and classic Kirby. Maybe borrowing from Sonic isn't the greatest idea, but you never know. A lot of high-profile games have come out recently on the Switch. Fire Emblem Warriors 3 Hopes, Monster Hunter Rise Sunbreak, Sonic Origins, Capcom Fighting Collection. But I want to talk about another recent release that may have flown under the radar, Elekhead. It came out on Steam late last year, but got a Switch release about a week ago. Elekhead is from Japanese indie developer Nama Takahashi, who also worked on Batloon. I first noticed this game during an Indie World presentation a few months ago. The clean pixel art style and puzzle-oriented gameplay really stuck with me, and the Steam version was overflowing with positive reviews, so why not check it out? Elekhead is a puzzle platformer where you control a little battery robot. The hero may be a distant cousin of Chibi Robo. As this cute little robot, you control electrical currents. If you are standing on a platform, that platform becomes electrified. This allows other machinery connected to the platform to turn on, which helps you navigate the level. For example, some platforms may extend if they are electrified, allowing you to clear larger gaps. However, obstacles may also appear, such as deadly lightning bolts that shoot up if you stand on a light bulb. The first few stages rely on this mechanic, but the real meat of the game revolves around not just simply standing on platforms or touching walls, but tossing your noggin around. All the electricity is stored in your head, and you can throw your head to different parts of the stage to electrify them. You then control your headless body that doesn't conduct electricity, and you'll need to fetch your head before moving on to the next area. You can be headless for about 10 seconds, and some puzzles revolve around you speedily grabbing your head before you, well, explode. I'll give you some puzzle examples to wrap your head around, assuming your head is not filled with electricity. One room has a wall connected to an elevator that goes down when powered up, but when you move away from the wall, it loses power and the elevator shoots to the top. So you need to quickly toss your head at the elevator to keep it powered on, then move your little body to the elevator and ride it up. The puzzles go way beyond just turning something on with your head, though. Sometimes you might need a certain area to be depowered, or sometimes gaps are too small to fit through with your head on, so you need to toss it somewhere to navigate smaller spaces. While the game is rooted in two very simple mechanics, jumping and tossing your head, Elekhead really gets the most out of the concept. Puzzles are not rehashed, but instead existing elements and concepts are built upon in very clever ways. It definitely does the Mario Kisho Tenketsu thing of introducing a concept in a simple manner, then making it a bit harder, then taking the same concept and twisting it in a new way, often in back-to-back rooms. Elekhead was hard for me to put down once I fully understood the game's mechanics. It keeps throwing creative puzzle after creative puzzle at you. You might have no idea where to even start with some of them, but you'll be smiling once you figure out the solutions. Two games that immediately came to mind when playing Elekhead are Box Boy and VVVVVV, or however you say it. You know, the game with all the Vs. All these games have very minimalistic graphics and focus on one-screen puzzles. Box Boy is more puzzle-focused, while VVV, etc. is more platformer-oriented. I would say Elekhead strikes a balance between these two games, but it leans more towards the more puzzle-directed gameplay of Box Boy. There are some great puzzles that revolve around reflexes, though. Like one floor is filled with light bulbs that activate bolts that one-hit KO you. What do you do? Well, just toss your head, jump up to grab it, and repeat until you clear the area without touching the floor with your electrified body. While Box Boy is more about just figuring out each puzzle, Elekhead does demand a bit more in terms of timing and precision. Your head kind of hovers a bit before falling down, so there are a few puzzles where you need to toss your head and then either do something while it hangs in the air or run over and catch it with perfect timing. It's still very accessible, though, even if something like VVV was too hard for you. The game has no live system and even gives you a self-destruct button if you want to blow yourself up to restart a puzzle. Nearly every room has a checkpoint, so Elekhead is very generous when it comes to forgiving the player for missing a jump or messing up a puzzle. The idea of having nearly every puzzle localized to a single screen keeps the game feeling fast-paced and constantly has that "I did it" feeling. Though you might go full genius mode on one puzzle, only to be stumped on the very next screen. The vast majority of the puzzles are fair, but there are definitely some head-scratchers. A few how-is-anybody-supposed-to-know-this puzzles. The game introduces illusion walls later on, and there are a few spots where you just need to throw your head and see what happens. There's also a super secret ability that I can only assume people found by sheer accident. I would still say 98% of the puzzles are solvable if you're clever enough. The game has a good number of secrets and collectibles. There are 20 golden keypads you can find, along with hidden color palettes. I tried out a few of them, but honestly, I like the default navy blue and yellow theme the best. I mean, electricity is yellow, right? We've all agreed on this. I don't want to hear about blue electricity. No matter what color you pick, the graphics still look great. It has a very clean look, but still enough details in the pixels to keep it from looking boring. I also really like the character Elekhead's design in general. I'd definitely buy an Elekhead amiibo. There are some fun visual quirks, like Elekhead's eyes will occasionally change, and you can even wear your head upside down. I'm not sure if this is completely random or if you can affect this, but it's a fun gag. I haven't mentioned the music yet, but it's filled with chill electronic tones that match the look perfectly. Definitely a lot of catchy parts that will get stuck in your brain for days. It took me under 3 hours to complete, and people much smarter than I am could probably clear it in about 2. If you want to 100% it, I can see it taking maybe 5 or so hours. It's $10 on the eShop, so do whatever calculation you need to determine if $10 is worth 3 hours or so of gameplay. Elekhead is definitely worth picking up if you are at all interested in it, though. If you're a big Boxboy fan, I feel this scratches a very similar itch. Now, if we can get a Boxboy and Elekhead crossover, that would be a Smash Bros. Level announcement. That's it for games. Now for the news. I'm going to keep the news a bit breezy this week, since obviously the biggest event was the Nintendo Direct. There are still a few things I don't want to ignore, though. One being, of course, Pokemon. A new TCG set was announced, Lost Abyss. Giratina is the cover boy, or cover dragon, I guess. This set reintroduces the Lost Zone, which is a second discard pile from which you cannot pull cards. They're gone forever, gone into the Distortion Zone. The set will also come with 2 high-class starter decks with VMAX and V-Star cards, one for Zeraora and one for Deoxys. I don't know if I pronounced that first Pokemon's name correctly, so bear with me. It'll hit Japan on July 15th. I actually bought some of the new Pokemon Go cards recently. There's some good art, and I had some nice pulls. The best, of course, being the secret Ditto card. It looks like a spinnerack, but there's a Ditto mark on the card. You then peel off the top to reveal a holographic Ditto card. I posted a video on Twitter, and artist Yuka Mori retweeted it, so life goal complete. Pearl and Marina are also returning for Splatoon 3. Their role isn't known, but they seem to have joined up with another band called Damp Socks in English and Busy Vacation in Japanese. The sample song is really nice, and while it was pretty expected for Off the Hook to return, it's nice to see some confirmation. They have some new outfits too. I'm always impressed by how fantastic the character designs are for the series. Though the big question is, how are they going to top these two for the new idols in Splatoon 3? Is Nintendo bringing in a team of scientists to design the perfect duo? I can easily see a Nintendo Direct for August solely focusing on Splatoon, so we will finally get our answer then. Bandai Namco and Ilka have established Bandai Namco Aces, a new company focusing on, quote, high-end photorealistic game content. Both companies are still independent from each other, but this marks a new collaboration between the two. Ilka, as you may know, is the developer behind Pokemon Brilliant Diamond and Shining Pearl. I enjoyed that game, but it's not exactly one I would point to in terms of high-end photorealistic game content. To be fair, they have worked on other games for the PS4, but even those projects don't fit the mold. The studio will likely be focusing on Ace Combat. I wonder how much of Ilka's attention this will take. I thought for sure that Nintendo will be using them in the future for other Pokemon remakes or even spin-offs, but maybe that might be a bit far away, so Ilka has decided to hitch their wagon to Namco for their next big project. Let's look at some Japanese sales data. Fire Emblem Warriors Three Hopes launched at 97,000 physical units. This is a great launch, and to put it in perspective, the first Fire Emblem Warriors only sold about 99,000 physically in Japan total. I'm not a Musou person, but it's undeniable that Koei Tecmo is finding a lot of success with their Nintendo collaborations. Hey KT, Pokemon Conquest 2. It's time. Nintendo Switch Sports also crossed 500K physically in Japan. It's doing very well in America too, and while it's not a cultural phenomenon like the Wii game, I think people will be impressed by the first quarter numbers when they get announced. Switch hardware is at 56K this week, up from 50K last week. There's been a bit of hardware lull these past few weeks, and 2022 is trailing behind 2021 by quite a bit. 2021 was still heavily boosted by Monster Hunter and the pandemic, but if we do get a new hardware announcement this year, I wonder if it has any chance of catching up. And now the Japanese gaming phrase of the week. This week's phrase is konsuto, konsuto. It comes from the English phrase counterstop, which is not something we actually say in English, but hey, people can use words however they want. Counterstop means you've reached the score limit, so it can't get any higher. You'll likely see this term used for old-school arcade games. Again, konsuto. Now for the Japanese tweet of the week. I picked one from @gametanteidan. This is actually the official Twitter account for a retro game store in Osaka. It shows the instruction manual and character art from racing game 04 Champ Doozy R. This series focuses on Japanese street racing, but the character art is actually really nice looking. You can only look at a car for so long before you want to see a human or two. As always, the tweet is in the description. That's all this time. Thanks as always for listening. Be sure to like and subscribe to this podcast on your favorite app. This podcast is also available on YouTube, so like and subscribe there as well. I'm on Twitter, Instagram, and TikTok. Just search for Tokyo Game Life or find the links in the podcast description. If you like the podcast, be sure to share it with your friends and on social media. If there's anything you want me to talk about or cover, don't be shy, just message me on Twitter. The next episode will be Sunday, July 17th. See you next time. Mata ne!